Great. Good morning, Kyle.
Hey, Ian. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
Glad to be here.
Yeah, great. It's the first episode of the Kyle and Ian To Be Named podcast. What you up to this weekend?
Let's see. Not much this weekend. I don't know. I'm getting over a cold this past week.
Yeah.
The one thing that my least favorite thing by far of having a child, I've got a 6-year-old, is that you just get so many colds and just wiped out. And like, yeah, I had this cold. It lasted for about a week, but I got over it about a week ago. But I'm still like recovering. Last night had some neighbors over and we watched the movie Cruel Intentions.
Oh,
from
okay.
1999. Does not stand the test of time, I would say. About like some teenagers that are like trying to like exploit each other for sex, and super wealthy. And it's got the Bittersweet Symphony is the sort of like theme song of the movie.
I don't know if you remember
that song by the Verve. It's an interesting look at 1999 and how far we've come.
Okay, great. Well, that's a wonderful thing to do with community. Get together and watch a Friday night movie.
Yeah.
Another week in the life. For this podcast, we want to talk about happenings in Seattle and Portland. That you and I know about, just because you know about stuff and I know about stuff, and we want to find out what's going on, what's interesting, and get your take, my take on issues that we think are important. It's a little hard to think about that stuff with all everything that's happening in the federal government right now. Though, do you have any quick kind of where are you at with our national scene?
I mean, it just seems so ridiculous and so destructive and so stupid that it's hard to even like give it much attention. And so I think I'm like struggling with like, yeah, how much to really like focus on it. I think, yeah, today I read an article for the first time about the tariff stuff. I have not been wanting to really engage with it because it seems like the Democrats lost and Trump is going to do what he wants to do for the next 4 years. And yeah, there's not that much that we can do about it. Yeah, I think that, you know, it shows, you know, that as Cascadia, as Portland and Seattle, I think we need to come up with more local solutions and local pots of money and not rely on federal solutions for things. This week I met with somebody who's on the Oregon Transportation Commission, which is the five people who, you know, vote on all the funding and decide things for Oregon's transportation. And you know, one of the big questions is how much do we spend on the Rose Corridor project, which is a freeway widening. They're basically going to double the width of the freeway through the city center in this one section. And it's a huge project. They're looking at $2 billion, of which they have like $250 million. So they need to come up with the rest. And they got another like $500 million to build these caps, which is kind of the most exciting part of the project. Yeah. And so sort of I think the way that I've been thinking about it is how can we sort of communicate the need to sort of right-size this project? You know, are there cheaper things that we can do to sort of mitigate the congestion concerns and get these caps built because we can't rely on the federal government for these huge projects.
Yeah, or to the extent that the federal government's going to fund anything, it's going to be the most destructive elements, probably, and not the ones that you probably really want, and it'd be beneficial for Portland. Yeah. Are they still talking about tolling for that, related to that project? I think that was on the table at one point in time.
Yeah, so this project came out of the 2017 transportation package that the state made. And basically the state lawmakers said, we want you to, you know, spend some money and fix the Rose Corridor and do the Columbia Crossing Bridge. And neither of those things have come to pass in the, you know, 8 years since they passed this. And now they're sort of like down to the wire. But one of the other things that they included in that that law was there was a piece that said that ODOT shall create a congestion pricing program, and that was an exciting part of that. And then a few years ago, the governor Tina Kotek said we're not going to do that, and removed that part. Because there was a lot of pushback from urban communities, especially. And I think that the state sort of took it as like a tolling program as opposed to a congestion mitigation policy. And right. So they were looking at how do we fund more freeway projects as opposed to how do we use this as a tool to reduce right. congestion so we don't have to do as many freeway projects.
Exactly. And as you can, so much you could do with smart pricing, different times of day, different types of vehicles to, actually use it as a tool to achieve what you want to achieve with your transportation system. And people might probably always going to think it's a money grab to some extent. Every time the government is looking for revenue, people have that reaction. But if the government doesn't see it as a money grab, that helps.
Yeah, and they were promoting it as a money grab thing and saying that this, right. they didn't even use the word congestion pricing. They just used the word tolls. Yeah, and, right. you know, you got to like set different prices. If there's no congestion, then have it be free. And if there is congestion, you know, charge people $1 or $2.
I know. I hope that the apparent success of the New York congestion pricing system is opening minds and opening eyes to how that could actually be really positive in cities outside.
Unless Trump gets rid of it, you know, I think that's been one thing that I've been really concerned about this week. Is, you know, that was one thing that Trump ran on. He said in the first week he's going to end congestion pricing. It's been two weeks, so he's a week late. But I guess he's been talking with the governor about, you know, revoking the authorization that they got, the federal authorization to do it. And they could also sort of leverage, you know, transit funding to make it so that the New York gets rid of it.
You know, I mean, I feel like they've got so much else going on, like dismantling like entire federal bureaucracy, like that seems like they would not have the bandwidth to also go after the program that they don't, you know, obviously have authority over. But also the other thing is, and I know this is like, okay, so I feel like I'm kind of a moth. I was trying to stay away from the news, but it's just like, so it's like historical. It's like so bad. And they're just dismantling. And it's so destructive, I think, is what you said. And that's very apt. But one of they released a memo, the transportation secretary, somebody, I don't know if you saw anything about this, about redirecting funding towards how they were going to redirect federal transportation spending money. What I was seeing getting people reacting to on Blue Sky was areas with higher marriage rates and higher birth rates, which is bizarre. A bizarre way to decide to send transportation money.
Wait, they were going to send it to places with higher.
Yeah, they've got a list. It's like six bullet points, and so those are like four and five, it's crazy. It's this is where we're at, man. It's weirder than I think anything that we are accustomed to being able to understand. But also the first bullet in that list is user fees, user-based fees. That was their first priority for how to redirect funding for the transportation system. So not that I would really expect ideological consistency or conceptual like consistency from this administration, but it would be like just a little bit extra stupid if that was the first thing they said they care about, and then they use that, and then they scrapped the congestion program in New York City, which is exactly a user-based fee. And see, you know, there was conversations about congestion pricing in Seattle a while ago before the pandemic, but you know, it's, and I'm sure the similar situation in Portland, where it's, we're trying to get people to, you know, there's, they want people to come downtown. They're desperate for people to come downtown again. And so that New York example probably is not going to be super relevant in Seattle anyhow.
Yeah, but Seattle has some demand pricing on one of the freeways, right?
No, it's, yeah, what is it? In, it's not in Seattle. It's some, it's like, I think 405 has HOV lanes, HOV plus lanes. So you can pay a toll if you're just a single person in a car.
Or if you're in a carpool, you don't pay a toll.
And that is based on congestion. So it goes up. Yeah, that's exactly right. And there's a, I think there's one on the highway that goes down to Auburn too. The Valley Freeway. So that's right. And I think they're successful. And the numbers show, there was some research done about this, because obviously, you know, people like to call them Cadillac lanes or platinum lanes or whatever, because, you know, it's free to sit in traffic and you have to pay more money to go in the lane, the HOV toll lane. But the research actually showed that the higher the fee was, the lower the median income of the users became. And because that was when the need was greatest. And so that it was like, if there's not very much congestion, you're like, yeah, whatever, I'm a rich guy, I'm just going to take that lane anyhow because I'm so great. But if the congestion is bad, more, you know, middle class and working class people sort of are like, okay, I need to go somewhere. I'm going to just pay the fee. This is, you know, a useful thing to me. So I thought that was pretty compelling finding.
Yeah. And, in Stockholm, they did the congestion pricing, and before they implemented it, 70% of people opposed the idea.
Right.
And then in a year, they did a vote on it, and 70% of people approved it.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, so we'll see if they get that reaction in New York, where there's ever, you know, there's a lot of opposition before, and if people come around, hard to know, you know, different, New York is different from Stockholm in a lot of ways, as you know. But yeah, we'll see. You were just talking about your dad, how your dad met Cesar Chavez, and I was hoping to, yeah, I'd like to hear a little bit more about that.
My dad, he grew up in Yakima, Washington, and he helped with some of the like farm union organizing. And went to one of the rallies that they had that he came and spoke at. And, I don't know exactly when this was, maybe in the 70s or something. But, I got to meet Cesar Chavez.
Okay, right on. Yeah, I don't have a great sense of when Chavez was active, but 70s seems like it. And why were you writing a letter about Cesar Chavez?
Oh, well, this was about a street in Portland called Cesar Chavez. Somebody was killed on it this past week. It's a four-lane street that is pretty dicey to cross, and this pedestrian was crossing it and got hit and killed.
That's awful.
It seems like there's some interest on the city council to do something about it. And so we're trying to figure out sort of how we can help message and support the city council people who want to do something on that street. And I think, you know, we had a very long discussion in sort of the Bike Loud, the bike advocacy group in Portland, about sort of what the best options are, either like a three-lane road diet. Do you like put parking there? Do you do like continuous, you know, bus lanes, bus only lanes, two continuous bus only lanes? But it seems like the big thing is just like, how do we reduce the number of car lanes on these streets
right.
and repurpose the space? And sort of mm-hmm. what's the best like political strategy for doing that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those four lane arterials are just about the worst. I mean, I guess they're better than a six lane, but they can be very, people drive fast and there's a lot of, you know, weaving and a lot of blocked visibility often, as you know. And is that part of your role as, are you on the Bike Loud board or anything anymore? Uh-huh. Yeah, okay, cool.
And so I think the pitch is, you know, getting back to our discussion about sort of local solutions, is Portland has this Portland Clean Energy Fund that is like a surcharge tax on big corporations operating in Portland. And it's raised, you know, I think like $200 million a year. It's raised more money than they thought. And there's a lot of interest in using some of that money for transportation projects. And so could we use that local money to, you know, do this transportation project?
Okay, cool. Mm-hmm. How is council shaping up? It's been a couple months now since they were seated, right? Do you have a sense of who might support this kind of thing? And are there any coalitions kind of forming?
Yeah, well, it's just been 1 month.
One month. Oh, my God. Okay. Yeah. All right. Very new.
Yeah, we went from four city commissioners who were each like in charge of different bureaus and they were elected citywide to 12 city mm-hmm. councilors that are elected in like four different districts using ranked choice voting and a lot of public funding. And yeah, there's definitely, you know, more of a, there's the left wing and then more of a moderate wing. And we saw that this week, one of the counselors, Angelita, she is well, like has a very big Instagram and social media platform. And she's kind of like the AOC of Portland. Her like handle is PDX Policy Angel. And
awesome.
She does these very like where she just sort of look in the camera and, you know, give her opinions about different issues very directly in a mm-hmm. in a style that's very similar to AOC. And okay. she talked about how some of the Democrats had voted for this like immigration bill that allows for the police to arrest more immigrants. And I think specifically like undocumented immigrants mm-hmm. and that some of the Oregon more moderate Democrats voted to support this. And the Oregonian did a whole article about it. And then it kind of became this flashpoint where you had different city council people like standing up and saying like, we support you. And then other people who, didn't say anything.
Okay.
And yeah. And so you can kind of see the ideological coalitions being formed there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, cool. Well, yeah, no, it's very early going, and I'm sure we'll look forward to hearing more about how that evolves. Going forward.
Yeah, they haven't really had to make any real decisions as a city council yet, and so that will be interesting. There hasn't been any disagreement so far. The only thing they've done is voted to increase their funding for their offices, so they can hire, I think, an extra person.
Oh, well, okay, cool. Support, good well-funded staff positions to do the research and analysis needed.
Yeah.
Is that their full-time? That's like their city council, that's like their full-time job, and yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I think the councilors make like, over $100,000 something a year.
All right, good. Okay. Yeah, you know, I was doing some research on this for work, and it was, you know, Portland was the last large city in the United States that didn't have council districts I looked at like the top 50 or 60 cities in population, and they all have districts. Seattle, you know, adopted districts like 10 years ago or something. So Portland was unique in that. And then now going to multi-member districts, I think is pretty unique too. It's not as unique as that, but that's it's a cool different system, and
yeah.
Exciting to see you guys turn it out.
Portland always has to do something unique, you know.
Just
do what everybody else is doing.
Yeah, it's good that Portland's out there doing that for us, for the rest of us. You guys have a new mayor too. You got any sense of him so far?
I mean, I think that he's like wants to be a real leader. You know, I've appreciated, he said that he's going to work 7 days a week until he gets this, homelessness under control in Portland. And yeah, he's articulate and, you know, really comes off as somebody who cares about people and about Portland and about fixing things. And yeah, I mean, they're facing a $100 million budget shortfall. So
right.
They've got like a lot of problems. And at the same time, they have to cut the budget by $100 million, which is like 5% of the whole budget or something like that.
Oh my God.
What is the entire Portland City budget?
Okay. Yeah. Right. Let's find out. We got some good keyboard sound effects there.
Yeah. Okay, so they have to remove $100 million out of an $8 billion budget.
All right. Well, okay. That seems doable. But yeah, Seattle's has to cut budget too. Obviously, the homelessness issue is rough, and we do not have that kind of energy. being brought to the problem here. The city council it's been pretty rough, you know, what's happening to the federal government, and then have the Seattle City Council. It's just been really like embarrassing lately. Just a lot of like, we've got their comprehensive plan update. So like really important, heavy, and this, you know, this is my area of expertise, stuff I care a lot about. And it's just the level of, like, you know, disrespecting the staff, reports, not doing the background research. I mean, really, like, I don't know. It's like, I do meetings, you know, I do this for work, and I do meetings with the public, and you always have people come in and just want to like grandstand and kind of complain about stuff. But you hope, and that happens from elected leaders too, but you kind of hope, like, from a city like Seattle, it's like a big city, and this is, again, their full-time job, and they have full-time staff who are supporting them, that you have a little bit of a higher level of conversation around these issues. And it's like some awareness of like what's even happening, what the process is, you know, what happened 6 months ago, and not have it just be acting like you're like deer in the headlights quite so much. And Seattle City Council is still in the process of working through the comprehensive plan, looking at zoning changes, maybe introducing new neighborhood centers throughout the city, which would be a new thing. We have these urban villages, I don't know, like 15 or something urban villages spread throughout the city. But other than that, it's the zoning is like very low density and hasn't really changed in, you know, decades, since the 90s. It's been pretty much set outside of those urban villages. And population is falling in most of those areas, even because of smaller household size, right? So we may get some changes, but it's pretty hard to say, and the current council doesn't inspire a lot of confidence, I would say. And the mayor's office is hard to read. They're kind of aligned with this current council, but they do have a bit more of an eye to the long term and some pretty professional, you know, staff and everything that are interested in the actual, you know, long-term health of the city, I would say. So they might.
Who's the mayor right now?
Where they're gonna land, but Bruce Harrell. He was on the city council for more than a decade, and then was elected mayor a couple of years ago. And, you know, I'm not, I didn't vote for him, but I think he's not doing a terrible job. We've had a couple of rough go rounds ever since Ed Murray, with the mayor's office. And he seems like he's at least more kind of stable, and capable, I think, than so we'll see. But the big thing in Seattle, if I can just keep going on Seattle stuff, is we're voting. Our ballots are, Grace's ballot is here on the table. I already submitted mine. Proposition 1A would be to create a funding stream for the Social Housing Authority. Here, a few years ago, we voted on proposition. What was it? February, I can see 2023. the voters here create a social housing authority, whose you know mission is to create a new kind of publicly owned housing in Seattle. And obviously, like, housing is very expensive in Seattle, and we have nonprofits that do affordable housing. We have Seattle Housing Authority, but they're, you know, that's a federal funded agency, and they're kind of locked in how much they can provide. So this would be a new other option for affordable housing. But because we have in Washington, I think it's probably a constitutional thing. When you do something by an initiative, it has to be like a single thing. You can't vote on multiple things in the same ballot initiative. So we created the authority, but we couldn't create the funding stream at the same time, which is silly. But here we are. So now, 2 years later, we're voting on the funding stream to fund this social housing. And first of all, this is frustrating because we had the signatures. I helped collect signatures for this a little bit, very, 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 very small, but I did help a little bit. And we had the signatures to put it on the November ballot, but the city council said, no, we don't really want the general, you know, presidential election voters to get to vote on that. We think that this would be better on a special election in February, and a low turnout election, which of course tends to skew more conservative. But so this has been a great campaign. I was out door knocking last weekend, but there's like a ton of organizations that are doing the canvassing. They've got these awesome little flyers, which are, I think, very informative and very nicely designed and have a great little graphic about the funding mechanism. And can I tell you what the funding mechanism is for social housing? Your housing that's going to be affordable to people, right? We have to buy the land and design the stuff and build the stuff, and then hopefully the rent will cover the maintenance once it's built. But okay, so this would be a new tax, a 5% tax on individual compensations over $1 million. So if you're a person who works at a company and you're getting paid more than $1 million a year, you're getting paid $1.5 million a year, which is insane, you would pay a 5% tax on that extra $500,000 above $1 million, right? And just the fact that, first of all, I know that there are very rich people out there, but it's just so hard to even imagine that there are people that make $1 million a year that you just don't, you don't need that much money. No one needs that much money. And that there's like enough of those people in Seattle that we can raise $50 million a year for to build social housing just by taxing those people at 5%, which is a very small number, is just mind-blowing to me. And also the fact that this would even be like, you know, there's even a question of this will pass or not is unbelievable to me. So yeah, we'll see. I am optimistic. I think that, like I said, there's been a great organizing effort around this, and I think that I work in housing. You know, I do housing policy like most of my day job. I work with cities on not Seattle so much, mostly smaller cities and suburbs on their zoning and looking at how to make more affordable housing. And I am super excited about this because so much of what we do is just tweaking around the edges. And even this is, I would say this is not bold enough to make as much of a dent, you know, as I would like, but it's a bold new option, new thing that could really help. So I'm excited about it.
When's the vote?
Ballots are due on the 11th of February. So yeah, we'll see.
Yeah. Trump can't touch that.
Yeah, that's right. I'm not, I don't know, I'm sure there's ways they could put up, but yeah, you know, most of our affordable housing is funded by federal tax credits, the LIHTC low-income housing tax credit program, which is a federal program. And first of all, it expires, it's like a 30-year credit. So even if you, 30 years goes by pretty fast when you're talking about buildings, you're talking about, you know, housing. And so those units that are affordable could, you know, if they're not, certain organizations will just keep them affordable even after the tax credit runs out. But that's the program is designed for you build affordable housing and then it stops being, you know, subsidized after some period of time. And yeah, the federal government could totally fuck that up.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, we'll see. And we got the legislature in session over here. I don't know. Do you guys, is your legislature going? Do you know anything about what they're up to down there?
Yeah, they are. I think this is like a shorter session this year than previous years, but the big thing is this transportation bill, and they're gonna make some sort of transportation funding package. They're trying to do some things with housing. You know, that's still a priority. I think one of the big issues is like how to increase housing supply in like Tillamook and, you know, along the Oregon coast and smaller communities that like have a harder time getting like investment banks to come in and be like, yeah, building a, you know, 80 unit apartment building makes sense in this small town. Mm-hmm. Would it make sense for like the state to do that, or, you know, how can we sort of incentivize that to happen?
Yeah, that's hard because it's those smaller towns. It's like the demand is lower and incomes are lower. So of course the people can afford to pay is less, but then construction costs are not much lower. And yeah, the financing is more difficult. And so yeah, I hope that they are able to help.
Yeah. But in a lot of these places, you know, if you did build a 80 unit apartment place, it would fill up and like there is demand, but it's just like hard to get it built. And so, yeah, maybe having like a state nonprofit that's set up that goes out and does that, or like helps, you know, make it happen or something could be useful.
Mm-hmm. So like the financing, you touched on, right? That's a hard thing. And something we've talked about before is that, you know, that what banks are willing to finance is determines so much of what our built, you know, our cities are like and what our, you know, our homes are like. And we're really kind of at the whim of the banks but these governments, state government, city governments, county government have bonding capacity. And I think theoretically, at least, could be the lender for a certain number of these projects, at least. So that could be, I don't know if they're thinking about that. In Oregon, King County has just been having conversations about doing that, using the King County Bonding Authority to help do this, you know, provide that financing, be that lender for those housing projects that need to get built and are going to be profitable, most likely. Like, it's not like it's a terribly risky investment, but just like the actual private sector lenders, you know, they've got other stuff. There's other shinier, you know, objects that they're mm-hmm. gonna go after for them. So that's kind of early on in King County. They're still just kind of working through that. So we'll see if they come up with anything. But I'm hopeful.
Well, as long as we're hopeful. So one cool thing in Portland is that, so we have like inclusionary zoning rules. It's like 20% of a new apartment building that's over, like 20 units has to have, like 20% of them have to be affordable. And we've set it up so that now, and we were having this big problem because people were building like 19 units. To build 20 units.
Mm-hmm.
And so now we've tweaked the policy so you get like a discount on property taxes to help pay for that. And hopefully that will spur some more development. But we're having a big shortage right now in Portland of, apartment buildings that are being applied for construction. We gotta make it more appealing somehow.
You've solved one part of the problem, and you have to come back and work on another part, and it's probably not going to be a silver bullet that fixes everything, and then the situation keeps changing. So that's good. At least it keeps me
Yeah.
from being too bored.
What sort of your take on like public, building public housing that's like built by like the government and owned by the government versus like private development?
I think it's great. I think the biggest thing with the housing, I think one of the
Which one's
hardest
great?
things when
Which one's great?
everything's great, it's all great. I mean, there's ways to do private housing poorly. There's great ways to do government housing poorly. There's ways to do them both well. I think the thing that we always fall into the trap, I think especially for housing, again, transportation, we also kind of fall into, is we just really think about our personal lives, and we kind of be like, okay, I live in a house, so everyone wants to live in a house, or I don't want to live in an apartment. If they build apartments, that means everyone has to live in apartments. And we're talking about these like huge distributed things, systems. It's never going to be, or hopefully, it's never going to be one thing is everything. It's going to be like there's this kind of thing, it fills this niche, this other kind of thing fills a different niche. And then the more options people have, right, they can, find seek something out that makes the most sense for them. And so yeah, I think it seems, I think I totally support government playing a role in the housing sector. It's like our government kind of really went for it, in the mid-century, and then kind of got a little over its skis, and then the backlash, those various other things happening, civil rights movement, and I don't know, yeah, whatever happened in the 70s, and everyone kind of soured on this whole idea, and now it's like illegal to expand federal housing, the Faircloth Amendment. But it seems like 10, 10 to 15%, 20% maybe of the housing supply being government owned seems like a pretty good, reasonable strategy, in my thinking. But then private, and then the private sector is making up most of the rest, and then there's all sorts of different variety in there. You've got individual homeowners, you've got big companies that own a bunch of apartments or a bunch of houses, maybe. You've got co-housing, folks out there playing a small role. So I just say variety and diversity are the recipe for what we want.
Yeah.
What do you think about that?
Yeah, like my thesis at the Lewis and Clark was about water privatization.
Oh,
And I started the
okay.
thesis with this assumption that like, oh, in Bolivia they privatized the water, and that led to this like whole like leftist wave, and the privatization was wrong. And that there's like a moral imperative to people being able to drink water, and that like by like putting a price on it and having people make a profit off of that, there's like something morally wrong about that. But what I discovered in my thesis research is that there are privately run and operated water systems that have some of the best sort of like outcomes, the lowest costs, the best water quality, and there's also publicly run ones that work well, and there's private ones that are poor and public ones that are poor. And so yeah, I think that what we need to do more of as a society is focus on like the outcomes that we want, and making sure that we're getting those outcomes, and having like clear goals of like what is our goal for housing, as a society, and not just leaving it up to private companies or just the government.
And then the government also setting guardrails on just minimum acceptable kind of situation. Super important.
Yeah, and, so. And all those like privately run water systems, like there's a lot of guardrails and government regulations accountability for that.
Yeah, we've got United States is such a funny country, and because we have a lot of things where we're like, oh, free market, everything, but then we have only like, we don't have a lot of private transit or transportation in the United States. The roads are all public. The bus systems are for the most part all public, apart from like Greyhound and one or two other inner city bus companies. The rail, Amtrak is all public. Starting to see a little bit of, we got Brightline now. And it's not like it would probably not be a good outcome, because a lot of these things couldn't support themselves privately. But having a little bit more of an alternative seems like could be beneficial in at least in certain areas where we're just, where it's all kind of locked in currently. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Hard to say.
And so maybe like getting back to our earlier, conversation about like pricing and, the Trump bullet point of like user fees, maybe there is congestion pricing, like there does need to be some taking the socialization out of our transportation system a little bit, and having the users pay a little bit more makes it, could make it a better running system.
That's
more accountable and like not falling apart.
I think that's certainly, there's certainly could be true. I think when we have these socialized systems, like, and then you have people in power who are, elites in government sort of structuring these systems, and who are elected officials, right, tend not to come from the lower rungs of society. And so it's very easy to kind of just set up your government-funded program to benefit the wealthy and powerful. And I think it's very easy for you to end up like that. You think in theory, like the socialism would be, one would hope it would be beneficial for people with less means, but I see this all the time in my work. And like what you're saying about setting housing goals, and you see it so often where the housing goals are set to, first of all, to protect the politicians, to keep the politicians, to prevent any kind of negative backlash or anything against the politicians. And so it's not about solving the problem. It's about posturing to, look like you're on the right side of the problem, and the problem can just keep existing because it's useful for people. Hmm. People who already have housing, like, it's not that new skin off their back. I think we're on the same page on that. It'd be good to have some more options. We don't have private roads, and I don't know if that would be good or not. It's kind of fascinating just because we don't have such things. I was reading a wonderful book by Ben Goldfarb about roadways and roadway environmental impacts of roads, a lot of it's about roadkill, but not just that. And it's like, forest service roads, with the runoff, they're super destructive, even though they're like little dirt roads, and big highways obviously totally can divide an ecosystem in half, and so that animals aren't able to cross. And all these things, but one thing they were talking about, I think it was in Brazil or maybe Mexico, but they were talking, it was like a privately owned highway, and they had this whole other, I don't know, it was like this whole, they had, they have this, all these roadkill prevention, and partly it's because like the highway is more profitable if there's less roadkill. So they had, they had more underpasses and stuff, and like video monitoring systems to try, because they really, it was like really in their financial interest, to have animals not getting killed by cars, and which really means letting it, enabling animals to cross the freeway, because they're going to try to cross one way or another. So if they have a safe way to get across underneath or over, mm-hmm. And then they're not getting hit by cars, and the cars aren't getting hit by animals, which is, can be couldn't really like mess up your vehicle as well. Anyhow, there's some kind of, it's a, I really recommend that book. I lent it to Andrew. I don't know if he ended up reading it or not. Worth checking out.
Hey Ian, I gotta go. We've got some guests that are coming to tour the old Cully Green co-housing place. Gotta go give them a tour.
Okay, well, great. With that, that'll be our first podcast. Thank you so much, Kyle.
Yeah, thank you. It's fun. Yeah. We've got a lot to talk about, and I think it's interesting to hear about what's going on in Seattle. And let's. We should do a follow-up podcast when the election results come in, and we can talk about.
Perfect. We can talk about how that went with social housing.
Yeah.
Great. If you're in Seattle, make sure you get your ballot in. Great. Can't wait to talk to you again, Kyle.
All right. Bye, Ian.
All right. That's the show. This podcast was recorded and edited by me. On behalf of Kyle and myself, I want to thank you all so much for listening. We hope to do this every 2 weeks or so, and so we'll catch you next time.